Good morning to all of you who were enjoying this beautiful day instead of being in lecture this morning. For those of you who hadn't seen yet, the quizzes have been returned, and I was just about to talk about how I grade the quizzes. Because what I normally do is I grade all of one question first, and then I go to the next question, then the next question, because I try to maintain as much consistency as possible. So if I get through a few of them and realize, oh, I need to fix the way I'm grading this, then I go back to earlier tests or quizzes and fix it before I keep on going. So that's why nobody gets them generally until everybody gets them, because I'm finishing up the last problem for everyone. So as much as I try to maintain consistency, I'm human. Even though I'm an evil chemistry instructor, there is a little bit human in me too. So I do make errors. And so if you think I made a mistake on something, particularly if I add up points wrong, you might just double check it, because over the years I've done this so much that I tend not to use a calculator, because for simple things it's just quicker to do it in my head. Not big things, but little. So, but that means, again, human can make mistakes, so just double check. If you find something wrong, just let me know and I can fix it. If you think, hey, how come I got this many points, but my friend got that many points, it might be due to the way that you phrased something. And it might be not necessarily even buzzwords, key concepts that I want to see that you have addressed. So if you have questions, then please don't be afraid to contact me. Now, oh my goodness. So, if you do have questions, though, about the grading, if you could put that in email or come in office hours to do that, because I'd like to take class time today just to get to lecture material. And I guess the first thing we're going to need to do is to review for the first exam, because I am supposed to give you a list of topics. So what have we done so far this quarter? Gases and intermolecular forces. We talked a little bit about shape, because we talked about water and methane and how that's related to intermolecular forces and boiling point. So there's a lot of topics. To be honest, there might be a lot of things from the quiz that don't end up on the exam, just because you've already done it once, everything's open note, doesn't make sense to repeat the same question so much. But there might still be things from the gas chapter that show up, like partial pressures or the real gas law, which, OMG, is the one thing I have to make sure to do today. So, and we did not already have this list of topics, correct? That was only my 12C class that we did that, right? Right, that's what I thought. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning with phases of matter. And there were microscopic properties, how the molecules behave, versus macroscopic properties. That then led to gases and units of pressure. I'll say this. There'll be no direct questions from the hydrogen gas lab. Those calculations you did were for the lab exercise you were supposed to be turning in. So I'm not going to ask about a height of water versus a height of mercury, but you do need to know what units of pressure are. And I guess because we've done it enough times, yes, you need to understand that height is related to pressure, because it's right here in the notes. We, of course, have the ideal gas law. And the variations. How to calculate density, how to calculate molar mass, the P1, V1, T1 over P2, V2, T2 questions. So let me put those out. So if we wanted to calculate moles, like if I gave you all the things except moles, if you wanted to calculate density, because there's a variation for that, molar mass, there's a variation for that, And I'll call it change in condition problems. Which that's your P1 V1 over T1 is equal to P2 V2 over T2. Yes, question.
Is it froze or just an M?
Oh, no. It already froze. Thank you. It updated right when I did that. Okay, 1 second. There we go again. Okay. So we have the graph. In other words, molecular energy distribution. That is what's related to vapor pressure. But just to be specific about it, good grief, I always forget how to spell their names. Clapeyron with a Y, right? Clausius. No Clausius-Clapeyron equation. That's in the lab. So again, the lab calculations are not going to show up on the exam. But you do have to know what vapor pressure is. Okay, so continuing on in the notes. I'm seeing that we did a bunch of PVT problems, and we have the box and the balloon, which again, I'm probably not going to ask again about it. But we have had some new topics since then, which include effusion and diffusion. And the relative speeds of gases. The fact that there's a relationship to molar mass and speed at the same temperature. And of course, the one thing that's really left that I need to talk about is the real gas law. Maybe I'll do that before we move on to the next chapter. But let me just make sure I got everything about gases that I wanted to get to. Yes. So now, in terms of the real gas law, let me find the section in your text for that. One moment. That is chapter 12, section... No, not chapter 12. Back to chapter 5, section 6. So let me just write out the one ideal gas equation I'd like to show you. And there's a lot more discussion of this in the text, but we're running out of time. So I'm going to skim over some of that discussion and again just show you the equation. So here's the real gas law, because there are even finer refinements. And this is the van der Waals equation. Van der Waals equation. And it looks like this. Oop. Missing one letter. N-R-T. Okay. I'm sorry.
NB?
It is NB as in boy, yes.
Okay.
There you go. So what are all these different variables that are in here? Well, it looks pretty much like PV equals NRT, just with some adjustments. Well, what are these adjustments? Exactly the ones that we talked about in class. So N is number of moles, B is related to the volume of gas, of the gas particles. Remember I said that those gas particles take up room and effectively subtract from the volume of the container. So here it is in equation form. And then what about pressure? Well, V is in volume here, N is moles, and A, that's intermolecular forces. Because the total pressure can be detracted from by these interactions between molecules. So that means that the real pressure that gases are applying, P, is less than this total pressure that includes their interactions. So there you go, the real gas law.
The V squared is volume also, right?
Yep.
V squared. Okay.
Okay, questions? Otherwise, take your screenshots and let's move on to the intermolecular forces chapter. Okay, here we go. And of course, it's lost its update. Let me see. Come on. Tim Cook would be very disappointed in you. There we go. So, intermolecular forces. And, I'm going to do it the way I did it in the lecture notes, because you know that I tend to rely more on lecture notes than the text as far as the way that I ask my questions. So, we did walk through the chapter the other day, so I made sure I caught up on everything, but I'm going to give you the topics more in the order that we discussed them in class. So, no, there's not going to be specific questions about Vesper, except that you have to have an understanding that some molecules are symmetric or not. And what is the relationship between symmetry and polarity? It is that if it's symmetric, it's less polar. If it's not symmetric, it's more polar. And we did have a discussion of bond versus molecular dipoles. So someone's requesting I go back for a moment. There you go. All right. So a bond dipole only depends on the atoms in it, but a molecular dipole depends on shape. And that's where we picked up in the lecture really next, where we talked about some examples. And we talked about relationship of intermolecular forces and phase. And that's the whole, to remind you, water versus methane thing. Water is, not only does it have polar bonds, it has an asymmetric structure. So it's really polar. Methane has slightly polar bonds, but they're all symmetrically arranged, so they all cancel each other out. And so it's nonpolar. Because water has high intermolecular forces, it has low vapor pressure. And because methane has low intermolecular forces, it has high vapor pressure. And so that would be the relationship between vapor pressure. Actually, let's do this. Intermolecular forces, how it relates to vapor pressure, how that relates to boiling point. Okay, then we have types of intermolecular forces. And we only talked about it briefly. Oh, here, sorry. I'll clean that up. There we go. So we talked about how ions, because they have actual full charges, they're going to generate stronger intermolecular forces. But we spent more of our time talking about permanent dipoles, which are due to structure, and they include hydrogen bonding. And then we talked about temporary dipoles, which include induced, and then the truly temporary, which are the dispersion forces. And I called those spontaneous or instantaneous. Those are the London forces. So, and the London forces, there were two very specific examples that we talked about. Iodine, which for a diatomic molecule is notable because it's a solid, but that's because it's got so much ability for the electrons to wiggle around, create so many dipoles, that it sticks together as a solid. A fatty acid, that because of its big size, sticks together. Now, there were these terms that we did in lecture, Keesome and Debye, and I don't care about any of those. That's just because I was trying to be systematic. But this is the way we talked about the different types of forces. So then that brings us to phase diagrams. And all the things included, like the triple point and the critical point, which brought us to water and its unusual behavior, which brings us almost to the present. Because the last thing that we have is energy changes in phase or temperature changes. That's where we take a block of ice, start out at a certain temperature, turn it into water, turn it into steam, calculate how much energy is involved. And of course, in order to have that discussion, we talked about phase changes, which there are six of them that we discussed. Freezing, melting, which is also fusion, evaporation, condensation, deposition, and sublimation. I'm not going to put surface tension on, but I am going to maybe have something about hydrogen bonding. And that is everything from that chapter. So no solids. Nothing from that last part of the chapter because we didn't get to it. Any questions about what's going to be on the exam?
This page is still on exam, right? Everything here?
Yep. Okay. Which means there's no way I'm going to ask all of this. It's too much stuff. But you can probably get a good guess of the types of thing I'd ask by looking at what we did in lecture. And yes, it will include that little bit of lab lecture we had, like on Vesper theory. One of the lab sections got a preview, but for everybody, what was the other thing we did? Hold on. Oh, yeah. Okay, but I'm not going to ask what ideal gases are. I already asked that question. Is there anything else in the lab notes that I'm forgetting? We talked about what vapor pressure is in the lab notes, so that's important. Nothing about spectroscopy. So the one day where we talked about vapor pressure in lab, that's a useful discussion to go back over as well. How many questions without being a jerk enough, meaning it will probably be 6 to 8, depending on how long each individual question is, because I still design the exams roughly to correspond to how much time it will take you in real life. Now, they might be slightly longer because I know you all have longer, but they're not going to be obnoxiously longer. Because after a point, it doesn't make any sense. Any other questions? Okay, so anything I say from now on is not on the exam, just to make that clear. So now, moving forward, there are three huge topics that you do in Chem 1B. Thermodynamics, kinetics, equilibrium. They have a lot of concept in each one of these topics, and there's plenty of math to keep everybody busy. These chapters, the way that they're presented in a general chemistry text, are presented because you're first-year students. And so information is given to you in a certain order, which is thought to be the correct or the logical or advisable way to do things. Not that I think I know better than everybody else, but I've been teaching for a while, so I have kind of my own way that I want to do it. And I want to first give you an overview of how these topics relate, so that when we start talking about pieces of it, you can understand the big picture. Because that's where the textbooks fall down, trying to keep a flow of what's the big picture. Okay? We can't get to all of these topics today. We can't get to all the details today. This is a story to just give you an idea. If you look at a reaction, for example, something like this. This is a substance known as bromomethane. Methane is CH4. Bromo means replace one of the hydrogens with bromine. And it turns out in real life, if you take a substance like this and you attack it with the ion hydroxide, hydroxide will very quickly react by attacking the carbon to push the bromine out. And so you'll get bromide as a byproduct. And then you'll get this other thing, which has an alcohol in it. And this is the substance methanol, commonly referred to as wood alcohol. It's not consumable, and in fact, it causes blindness. So it's a reagent that is commonly used, but you do have to treat with some care. It turns out, excuse me, that the reactants are higher in energy than the products. And for the moment, let's just call it E. Now, what's this x-axis going to be? Something called reaction coordinate. And you're going to get the long, painful definition of that later. Promise. But for right now, it is the most likely pathway through a reaction. In all the ways that the atoms or molecules have to interact, we're just going to assume they do it in the best way for the reaction to occur. And if we follow from the reactants to the products, and we take one set of molecules as they react, it turns out their energy will change like this. So there's a hill they have to get over first in order for the reaction to occur. It's kind of like if you went on a water ride. If you get up high enough, and it's designed right, then once you get over that highest point, it's literally all downhill from there. Same thing in a chemical reaction. That highest point on the diagram is something known as a transition state. Because you're transitioning from products to reactants. The amount of energy it takes to get there is something known as activation energy. And the bigger it is, the harder it is the reaction to get started. Here's another example. A match. No matter how angry I might be and how long I stare at a match, it's not likely to light itself. Because if it were, well, I'd be out doing superhero thing, right? So, but as soon as you strike that against the right kind of surface, that gives it the energy it needs for the reaction to occur and then to keep on going. That's what activation energy is. In that same example of a match burning, or in this example of the or chemical reaction I'm showing you here, between the reactants and products, you can tell that there is energy released. And right now, for our purposes, we can call that the heat of reaction. Heat of reaction is the difference in energy of reactants and products. This involves thermodynamics. We're talking about energy. But it also involves kinetics, which is the study of how or how quickly reactions occur. So on the left here, the diagram is the thermodynamics part. On the right-hand side here, where you see how the reaction occurs, well, there's a relationship between those two things. Sounds like a nice story, right? I mean, it makes sense. It's the chapter we're supposed to do next, and we're not. For two reasons. One, the lab that you traditionally do for this topic doesn't come until later in the quarter. And so it makes more sense for me to delay it. Two, this whole way I think about these three topics, I used to teach it in a different way. And then a couple years back, I kind of like had a revelation, you could say. And so where I want to go wet next is this topic of equilibrium. Because looking at the diagram that's already on the page there, I set you up to say, okay, reactants on the left, products on the right, and if you grew up writing, well, most Indo-European languages are from left to right. So if you're like me, where you tend to do things from left to right, you're set up to say, okay, that's forward. But what if the products end up with a lot of energy somehow? Couldn't the products somehow climb back over the same thing and fall back apart and become reactants again? Sure, why not? We see things rust, and, well, that's not a good example, because where would that come from? Here's a perfect example. Do you all know how oxygen gets to your cells? You all had that bit of biology. Like, I didn't, because I did other things. I didn't have to do biology at the college level. I took it at the high school level. But if you don't know how it works, you've got your diaphragm, all that, the muscles that cause a pressure difference to occur. Air comes into the lungs. It goes into these little sacs, these alveoli, that have blood vessels around them. The point comes where they're thin enough that oxygen is able to penetrate across that, gets into the bloodstream, and then attaches to hemoglobin, which is a macromolecular structure created of four different protein units, where two of them are the same as each other, and the other two are the same as each other, and all four of them have an iron center. And it is oxygen attaching reversibly to that iron center, meaning it'll attach, but it'll also get released again. And that's how oxygen is able to transit through the body. Now, if you have something like carbon monoxide, you know, think of old school murder mysteries before people had electric cars. Why would you never leave your car running in the garage? Carbon monoxide builds up. Carbon monoxide grabs onto those iron centers and holds onto them tight, doesn't let go again. So if your iron centers are saturated with carbon monoxide, they can't carry oxygen, which means there's no you. Now that's reversibility in chemical reactions, and that's equilibrium. equilibrium is all about the balance of energy in reactants and products in a reversible reaction. So up until now, even myself included, you might not have even heard your instructors talk much at all about the fact that reactions can reverse. How many details of chemistry can you handle at once? So there reaches a point where we're like, okay, here's some new chemistry for you, and it's that reactions can go backwards. Here's a very simple one, an example chemical reaction. The gas sulfur dioxide can react with oxygen, you could say burn, to reversibly form sulfur trioxide. And so that new kind of arrow that I used means reversible reaction. It turns out this reaction is favorable. And I'm not talking about just one set of molecules reacting, like what's up above. I'm talking about the whole sample. Like, if this thing is reversible, which means it can go back and forth, where's that balance point going to be? And where is a piece of paper so I can show you? This may seem like a rather silly example, but this is what's going to go on in chemistry. Now, first of all, from your perspective, am I raising my left or right hand?
Left in perspective, in my perspective.
From your perspective, I'm raising my left hand. Okay. And so this is right hand here?
No, but in your perspective, it's going to be left, left.
Like, what do you see on your screen right now? Which hand am I waving?
Right.
That's your right hand. Okay. Yes. And this is my left, your left hand, right?
Yes.
Okay. So this is reactants on the left, and this is products on the right. Suppose that we had like something that I'm showing you there, where something's burning. So it's likely that the reactants are higher in energy than the products. See where the pen's lying? The reason I'm showing this example is because this kind of chemical energy could be thought of as a type of potential energy, which I usually avoid that whole discussion because it just gets really painful for you and me. So, but that's what gravity could be thought of as well, that you've got a higher energy in the gravitational field versus lower. And look where the pen lies. Not all the way down here at what the lower energy, even something lower than that. Right? So here's the higher energy state, here's the lower energy state, and here's where the pen rests in between. Now, if I could pick that pen up and move it up the paper and let go, it's going to fall right back down to this lowest point in energy, right? So what's the only thing that could change where this point lies? Change the points where you start and end. So now this would literally be an uphill situation, where it would take energy to push this to get all the way to the end. Now, just substitute reactants and products, and this pen represents equilibrium. It represents where is that balance of energy between products and reactants. Now, I'm going to put a graph in the notes that looks just like what I showed you here. All right, this is a different kind of diagram because it's not, as I said, for the one up above, just one set of molecules. It's the whole solution. So now I'm going, or mixture or whatever term you want to use it, the whole system. So let's say I'm trying to convert from 100% reactants to 100% products. And in the case of something burning, the graph would look something like this. So again, on the left, we have reactants. On the right, we have products. And this lowest energy point here is going to be given the letter K, which that is equilibrium. The lowest point in energy. In a reversible reaction. What's a good example of a non-reversible reaction? Hydrogen burning. It's in theory reversible, and we're going to get to that. But if you calculate the constant of where that balance is, it's so enormous that it would be like one molecule survives that whole process and doesn't react, for example. Another way that something couldn't be reversible is if you didn't keep it contained. Like this is a set of gases reacting. What if one of the gases leaked out? The balance would be disturbed. And we'll talk about how to handle that conceptually and in terms of calculation. Because for those of you who hate math, this is where the math starts again. Yeah, I just heard the collective groan out there on the internet. And let me introduce a little bit of that math in the little bit of time we got left here. But first, take your screenshots. And then I want to talk a little bit about what this K is.
What does the P stand for again? The
products. P. Reactants products. And products.
Okay.
All right, let's go on to the next page. There we go. So in a more advanced discussion of this topic, there's something called chemical potential. And it really is just like potential energy. How much energy does this system have? So the quantity of reactants and products at equilibrium depends on the difference in energy between them. There's an equation you're going to learn later on that backs up what I'm going to say. This thing on the left is technically something known as free energy. And you don't know what that is yet because you haven't learned it yet unless you've had chemistry before. So right now, it's just the quantity, the difference in energy between the reactants and products. Someone inevitably is going to ask, how's that different from delta H? And I'm going to say a whole chapter different. So we're going to get there. Right now it's energy. What is K? The equilibrium constant. And again, it's related to energy. Now, here's the part where I'm going to like... If you can think back to the Clausius-Clapeyron equation, that discussion we had in lab, I said there's this exponential equation that's going to pop up in different places, right? So what if you raise both sides of this equation, put it to E, like E to the delta G and E to the negative blah, 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 blah. You're going to get something that looks like the Clausius-Clapeyron equation again, eventually, when you do enough playing around with it. So the point is this, that there is a direct tie-in between K, the concentration, and then once you take its log, energy. So that's my hand-waving way of saying this, that the format of an equilibrium constant is essentially concentration of products over concentration of reactants. So concentration of products over concentration of reactants. Now here's what every chem book everywhere ever does. It comes up with this random reaction, A and B reacting together to form C and D. The lowercase letters, those are the stoichiometries. And the other letters are the substances. Just so there's no confusion there. So reactant A has A moles that reacts with B moles of reactant B to form C of C and D of D. If you have such a reaction, then under normal circumstances, which we'll get to exceptions later, you would write this as C to the C power times D to the D power over A to the A power times B to the B power. Why? Because math. Was that good enough? Okay. Why? Chemical potential and logarithmic and exponential functions related to chemical energy distribution. So we don't really want to know why, Dr. Gray. That's right. Now, because I gave you an example reaction, and let me literally copy this reaction to just show you in real life how an equilibrium constant can be generated. The format of it. So in this case, K would equal the products, sulfur trioxide, raised to their stoichiometric coefficients, 2. Over reactants, sulfur dioxide squared, and then oxygen, not raised to anything because it only has a 1 in front of it. Now, what do we do with these constants? What do they mean? There's a lot of details left, but the story is this, if I can back up a little bit. If the iPad's going to... Oh, come on. It's the Enelecture iPad. You have failed me for the last time.
So the K value is different, depends on the reaction, right? Or is it the same value for...
I'm sorry, I'm having a technological breakdown. There we go. What were you asking?
I'm asking, is it the K value is going to be different for each different reaction?
Oh, of course. Yes. Oh, okay. Yes, and that's what we're going to talk about. Like, what does K mean? If K is big, like in this reaction... It turns out the value happens to be 279. So after the reactants and products come to their balance point, it turns out you're going to have more products. That's why the value ends up being big. The theoretical reason why is up at the top of the page there, that if you have a large amount of products, you're going to have a very negative free energy. And it turns out negative is good. So when you release energy, reactions want to happen. That's why the equilibrium gets towards products. And that's what this graph is about here. Someone was asking to see the previous graph. So the one on the bottom of the page is showing the average energy in solution. And the more favorable the products are, the more that products are going to form. What's on the following page is the concept and the math that's behind this graph. And if everybody's confused, that's because I'm doing overview. And when you start reading the equilibrium chapter, it's actually going to start with what's on the last page here. It's going to start with what an equilibrium constant is. And it's going to show you some of the math and give you some of the concept. And then we'll eventually get to more what I'm presenting here. It is a unitless constant for reasons that we'll eventually get to. But we will get to it. If you want the real answer, it's because we do these things that are called activities, which we divide through the units by a reference unit, which cancels the units out, which then allows it to be put in an equation, which allows it to be equivalent to energy.